this point, if we were on Zoom, we would have been enjoying listening to the hymn 102, I the Lord of Sea and Sky.
Oh, we're doing that after the sermon.
Sorry?
Oh, we're doing that after.
Oh!
We're doing that.
We'll come back to it. It is indeed time for the sermon. Verse from Psalm 19. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. We enjoy this morning two wonderful readings, very dramatic, both involving the sea. The psalmist starts by praising the Lord. O give thanks to the Lord, for he is gracious. Then, almost anticipating today's gospel reading, we have those who go down to the sea in ships. They were at their wit's end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper, and the waves of the sea were hushed. If we read the psalm completely, there is a theme shared by four persons: the traveller, the captive, the sick man, and the sailor. Their circumstances are all different, but for all four, as they cry out to God in their need, God hears and answers their prayers. The psalm describes God's unchanging love in responding to his people. And may I dare to suggest that when one has a spare 5 minutes, this psalm is a good read. It is Father's Day. I opened two cards myself this morning that came in the post earlier in the week. And if, as many, we were out for a Sunday lunch, the psalm would now be our starter, and we would move to the main course, which is Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel is the shortest at 16 chapters and is considered the first Gospel. Tradition is that John Mark wrote it in Rome, setting down what he was told by the Apostle Peter. Peter was sharing with his friend Mark his memories, both good and not so good, of his times with Jesus. Perhaps because the writing is in Rome, it offers explanations for Jewish customs that would not be apparent to non-Jews. That's for our benefit. If Matthew's Gospel concentrates on the saying of Jesus, Mark's Gospel concentrates on Jesus' actions. Mark's Gospel jumps in at the deep end of Jesus' ministry. No room for Bethlehem, birth, or flight to Egypt. Mark starts with John the Baptist. Jesus travels from his home in Nazareth in the province of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Then Jesus is sent into the desert for 40 days to fast and be tested by Satan. When I visited the Sea of Galilee, there was and still is the Yardinit baptism station, where for $30 you may hire a white baptism gown, you can join a long queue and have an immersion baptism with your own minister or with the duty minister. It's very popular with Americans in what they claim is the River Jordan, where Jesus was baptized. I was traveling with a British coach party that day. We only had time for a photo stop, as it's called. And yet again, our Jewish guide had to share his skepticism of this site with us, suggesting that where Jesus was baptized was 110 kilometers to the south, much nearer to Jerusalem. After fasting, Jesus returns to Galilee and selects four fishermen, as recorded in Mark 1, verse 14. And his early ministry begins, healing, preaching in both synagogue and open air. There are subtle changes when we get to chapter 2, where challenging questions are asked about Jewish traditions, fasting, and the Sabbath. And a few Sundays ago, our reading mentioned that scribes had come down from Jerusalem find out about Jesus. And they tried to ridicule him. Very early on, the Jerusalem establishment were monitoring Jesus' actions and his teaching. And it seems to me there was an arrogance within the Jerusalem establishment. How could the son of a northern carpenter be as clever as them? Time and again, attempts were made to trap or to catch Jesus out. They always failed. But we have to remember the context here, that there was a very tense truce between the Romans, who occupied the Holy Land, and the priests in Jerusalem. The Romans had allowed the temple and Jewish worship to operate as long as they had their taxes paid. The Romans believed in many gods and found Judaism believing only in one God very strange. But the Jewish establishment were frightened that their security, their whole way of life, would be destroyed if any prophet or leader broke the delicate truce with the Romans. Hence their fear that Jesus might destroy their way of life. And not long after the crucifixion, there was rebellion, and the Romans destroyed the temple, except for what used to be called the Wailing Wall, or is now called the West Wall. By chapter 3 of Mark, Jesus had chosen the 12 disciples. Chapter 3 records the healing of the man with a paralyzed hand on the Sabbath in the synagogue. To us, this symbolizes Jesus' compassion, his caring for those in need. But to the Pharisees, this was blasphemy. And it's recorded they met at once with members of Herod's party. Now, Herod's party and the Pharisees hated each other, but they combined with the one concept of planning to kill Jesus. In the early part of Mark 4, we enjoy the wonderful agricultural parables. I love those. Today's reading from Mark 4, verse 35, is still early days. There's many more chapters to come. The disciples had seen Jesus in action, both healing and teaching. Jesus had taken the disciples aside to explain parables to them, so they should have had a great understanding of what was happening. Jesus, after a hard day's teaching and healing, is exhausted. He knows if he tries to spend the night in a local village or town, there would be no peace. There would still be a crowd wanting their relatives healed. So Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go across the Sea of Galilee to the other side," leaving the crowd behind. If this was ITV, this would be an advertising break. Back around 2012, on a very wet and cold winter's day, I was searching the internet for holiday bargains, and I'd always wanted to go to the Holy Land. Eureka! I found a bargain almost too good to be true. So I phoned my usual orbital travel agent, and they said, "No one's here, come on down. Do you want your usual coffees?" So we went down. I took a print out of the internet bargain and handed it to the manageress. She had a quick look and laugh and said that can't be true, but she did read the phone head office and was shocked to be told, "Take their deposit today. The offer is withdrawn by close of shop." October found us in Taba. Taba, if you think to the Red Sea, there's a V at the top of it, halfway up the side of the V, between really Egypt and Israel. And it had three great attractions for us. Firstly, we should have been able to visit St. Catherine's Monastery. My wife's name is Catherine. It is one of the oldest working monasteries in the world. And traditionally, you climb up the mountain to the top in the dark, and you enjoy one of the best sunrises in the world. There are no cities, no pollution from St. Catherine's to the Persian Gulf and beyond. You get the perfect view of the sun coming up. Sadly, the Egyptian government, which was new at the time, had cut off the grants to the Bedouin, so they cut off the road, and we never got to the monastery. We had hoped to go to Petra. Now, you may not know where Petra is, but you will remember probably watching the film of Indiana Jones that was filmed in the Petra area. Again, sadly, the new Egyptian government had banned the ferry from Taba to Aqaba, so one couldn't go to see Petra, but we could go and did go to Jerusalem. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is halfway on this coach journey where you get in Egypt to the border with Israel, you have to get off the coach, walk through the Egyptian and the Israeli border posts, and then you board an Israeli coach. You go up to the side of the Dead Sea. If you look in your Bibles, the map always shows a lovely long sieve of the Dead Sea. Sadly, that is no more. We did stop halfway up the Dead Sea where there's a red mark on the cliff, and that was put there by the Palestinian Exploration Fund, which is a combination of the Cambridge and Oxford University's geographical societies. And that marks the edge of the sea. Well, from this red mark on the sea, sort of somewhere around there, there is a road, the new big road from Eilat to Jerusalem. And then there's miles of scrubland. And just down at the very bottom, you see the edge of what is now the Dead Sea. And that shrinkage has taken place in the last 100 years, mostly in the last 5 years. I say all this because when I visited the Sea of Galilee in 2015, it was after 5 years of drought, and the level was the lowest it had been in over 100 years. And it was difficult to imagine what appeared to be a quite small lake in front of you would have been the great sea where there was a storm for Jesus and the disciples. So we have to think that if you see any travel brochures of a little Sea of Galilee, really a little lake now, it would have been far bigger at the time Jesus was there. Returning to the reading, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go across to the other side, leaving the crowd behind." I have two thoughts on that. We're told evening has come, so it would be dark. In the more southern countries, twilight is quite short and you go from light to dark very quickly. So it's dark. Seven disciples were fishermen. They would have known the Sea of Galilee well, and a night crossing should present no problems. They set off, and unexpectedly, a great gale arose. There is a valley at the north end of the Sea of Galilee where a river comes down from Lebanon. And if the wind funnels through that valley, it does shake up the Sea of Galilee and produces great waves. I think Jesus would have been crossing from the west to the east, and the waves would be going from the north to the south. So it would be very difficult in a small boat with those great waves would be coming over the side. And there was collective panic. And again, we've got to remember that for us, with health and safety, with life jackets and other things, they wouldn't have had any of that. And they were scared out of their minds and worried stiff. Was the boat going to fall apart? Were they going to drown? There's no question of swimming to the shore. But at least they had enough faith to know Jesus would solve the crisis. He was woken, and in the words of the psalmist, he made the storm be still. Jesus then challenged his disciples, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" But years later in Rome, awaiting trial, Peter remembered this and shared this story with Mark, which is quite remarkable. He's done a couple of disciples in the best light. I have a great friend who's a Yorkshire vicar who baptised my daughter Helen, and he always posed the question when studying the Gospels, why did the writer include this passage? And I invite you to share that thought today. It seems to me the passage is included as one of enormous encouragement to us. If the disciples were frightened in the dark during a storm, so we may be. Just as the disciples turned to Jesus, so may we. We are a small congregation. We do prayerfully care for each other. We are challenged by a variety of problems. It never ceases to amaze me, amongst our small number, how many of us and our extended families are affected by cancer. But this passage directs us to have faith and to pray to Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.